everybody?
Hi.
All right, I'm just going to start out by saying that I'm not Cynthia McKinney. I apologize to those of you who were coming here tonight expecting to hear her speak. It was unfortunate that she wasn't able to be here tonight. Sarah called me this morning and asked if I could fill in. So I'm just going to do the best I can with that. Some kind of big shoes to fill, but I'm just going to talk to you for a few minutes about who I am and what I've learned and sort of what my part is in all of this. Like Sarah said, my name is Katrina Plotz. I have been a member of the Anti-War Committee since 2006. And a lot of what I'm going to say tonight is based on a talk I did about a month ago at the Walker Library about our role as solidarity activists in a post 9/11 context. So for those of you who were there for that, this is going to be familiar. But basically, in thinking about what it means to be a solidarity activist, at its most basic level, it means supporting people who are standing up for justice everywhere, whether it's here, whether it's somewhere else in the United States, or anywhere else around the world. But as an activist here in the U.S., it makes sense to take a particular interest in and to feel a responsibility towards becoming educated about the ways that our tax dollars are spent in places where the U.S. military wages war, and also in countries where our tax dollars are used as military aid to repressive governments in places like Colombia, for example, and in Israel and Palestine. And as international solidarity activists, part of our job is to raise awareness about what's going on, spread information, and let people know what they can do. And one of the best and most effective ways that we can do this is to actually travel to these countries where our tax dollars are having a big impact, and to speak with people whose lives are being affected by it on the ground every day. And so I have a little bit of experience with that. I had the opportunity to travel to Colombia in 2006, and with some other people from the Anti-War Committee, as well as some activists who are involved with the Colombia Action Network. And that was a really great experience. We met with trade unionists and student organizers and human rights activists, and we were able to travel around the country and meet with people and then bring those stories back to the United States. And so that is the kind of thing that I had in mind and that I was really excited to do when the opportunity came along in 2009 to travel to Palestine. And I'll just say a couple things about the unique challenge of Palestine solidarity work. First of all, one thing that I've kind of come to realize is that in comparison to the Colombia solidarity work, there's not a lot of people who know much about what's going on in Colombia. They might know there's a lot of conflict there and that it has a lot to do with cocaine, but people don't know a whole lot. With Palestine, there's a lot of people who don't know as much about that either, but just in comparison, there are far more people who claim to know something about the nature of the conflict there, or at least they have strong opinions about what is going on there, and very set beliefs about why there's conflict there and who is at fault. And these beliefs and feelings are oftentimes actually based on lies and on myths and false information, often involving racist stereotypes about Palestinians being terrorists. And this false information doesn't just come out of nowhere. It's actually a deliberate campaign of propaganda by the Zionist lobby, Zionists being extremists who believe that the whole land was now Israel, it was, is like the God-given homeland for the Jewish people, and that the Palestinians have no place there, and that they should be forcibly kicked out or removed as people who don't belong there. And Zionists have a very strong influence in this country on our politicians on both sides of the so-called political aisle. And so there's a lot of misinformation about the real nature of the conflict there. A lot of people believe that any Palestinians who resist the occupation in any way are terrorists, that they're hateful, that they're Islamic extremists, versus the image of Israelis, which is often, they tend to be viewed as more moderate and secular, and people talk about Israel being the only democracy in the Middle East. But I'll just have some more things to say about that later. So as international solidarity activists, particularly in regard to Palestine, we not only have to raise awareness, but there's a lot that we have to do to counter preconceived notions that people have and very deeply held beliefs that often carry a lot of emotion for people. So it's quite challenging, and it often comes about that people who, just from my own experience, I don't know, maybe some of you can relate to this, people who speak up for the rights of Palestinians or who are critical of Israeli policies are very, very often called anti-Semitic and are accused of being anti-Jewish and of being hateful, and it's a very common accusation that is leveled against people who, you know, are speaking the truth about what's happening there. So that's just another challenge and another thing that we have to be prepared to deal with as we talk about what's happening in Palestine. So if it's not really about religion or anti-Semitism, then what is it about, I guess, is the question here. And so I'm just going to go through some of the background on the history of the conflict. I'm sure that there are many of you in this room who might know some of this and who probably know a lot more than I do. But for those of you who might not know, I just want to provide a little bit of background on like how did the situation get to be the way that it is. So to understand what is at stake there and what some of the issues are, it's really important to know about the manner in which the state of Israel was founded. So this actually goes back to 1917, the British government, which controlled Palestine after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, signed what was called the Balfour Declaration, which promised that a Jewish state would someday be established there. So right away, this is a European power making a declaration about a non-European territory where there are indigenous Palestinians who have been living for thousands of years. So you can see where this would maybe be problematic. And then when the United Nations made Israel a state in 1947, Jewish people were only a small minority of the population in Palestine at the time, and they owned only 6% of the land. And but when the United Nations was establishing this country for Israel, they made what was called the Partition Plan, and according to that agreement, Israel was going to have 55% of the land, and then Palestinians were going to have 45%. Which is in and of itself unjust. But right after this partition plan was announced, there were Zionist militias who attacked Palestinians within the 45% that was going to be designated as the Arab state, and they drove them from their homes. And so the Zionists were never planning on just leaving it as like a 55-45 agreement, like let's coexist together. They never really agreed to that or had that in mind. Their goal was to completely drive Palestinians out of their land. And so they attacked villages, and they killed people, they drove people from their homes, and they created thousands of refugees in the process of this. They did this from 1947 to 48, and they ended up driving a total of around 750,000 indigenous Palestinians from their homes. And so by the time that was over, by the end of 1948, Israel had claimed 78% of historic Palestine, and Palestinians were driven into the West Bank and Gaza, which are two small portions of land that are disconnected from each other. But then in 1967, Israel attacked and occupied those territories as well. And they've been controlling virtually every aspect of Palestinian life ever since then. So when you hear about the occupied territories, that's the West Bank and Gaza, and those were never meant to belong to Israel. They're being occupied and controlled illegally by the Israeli government. And so supporters of Israel often talk about Israel as the victim, or as if they're seeking only to exist, and they're in the middle of all of these hostile enemies, and so they need to be protected, and they need to have this special alliance with the United States in order to be safe from all of their enemies around them. But the truth is, they've been a rogue state from the very, very beginning. They never accepted the unjust partition plan as it was established by the UN, and they continue to occupy land that they have no legal right to, even under international law. This was proven when they occupied the remaining 22% of Palestinian land, and even back in 1949, when they were officially admitted to the United Nations. It was on the condition that Palestinian refugees would be allowed to return home, which is their right under international law. And Israel agreed at the time, but they have never complied with this. And they also repeatedly violate Article 49 of the Geneva Conventions, which states that an occupying power cannot transfer its own civilian population into land that it's occupying. But settlements in East Jerusalem and then throughout the West Bank are examples of this. And it's interesting because the word settlement sounds so harmless and so soothing almost, like, oh, they're just going there to settle. But really, you know, anybody who knows about the way the United States was settled and the way that the land was stolen from the indigenous people of this country. Settlement involves force and violence and stealing from people what is theirs and taking it over. And so this isn't a conflict about religion. It's a conflict about land, and it's about stolen resources. It's about the denial of the right of return, and it's about people who are being denied their basic human dignity. So that's kind of some of the history, and then I'll just say a few things about what I've read about Palestinian life today. Like I said, nearly every aspect of life for Palestinians is controlled by the Israeli government and military. And I'll just give a couple examples of these. Palestinians sometimes have to wait for hours at checkpoints where soldiers check their IDs and search their stuff and often detain people either right at the checkpoint or they're later imprisoned. There's a lot of arbitrary detention of Palestinians that goes on. And in the meantime, Israelis move about freely and quickly, often on settler-only bypass roads. So there are roads going through, like, the West Bank, which is an occupied territory, that are, like, by law, only accessible by Israelis. And Palestinians oftentimes struggle to obtain permits that are required for them to travel, to work, to build, even on their own land. Hundreds of Palestinian homes have been demolished because the proper building permits were supposedly lacking. The Israeli government also uses home demolitions as collective punishment for families and associates of people who resist the occupation. And then for those of you who follow like what's happening in Palestine, I'm sure you might be familiar with the 20-foot tall security fence, or what is called by Palestinians the apartheid wall, which separates the West Bank from Israel. It's supposedly there for security reasons, but the way the wall was built, it curves significantly eastward. And if I had a map, I could better show you how it happens. But basically, it was built in order to annex or like take large sections of Palestinian farmland and water resources that were like taken from the Palestinian side, and the wall is built so that it confiscates this land and resources from Palestinians. So, and then of course the violence that happens. An occupation cannot be maintained without violence, and so you have attacks at checkpoints, you have assassinations, and then you have like some of the most horrific examples of violence, such as in December 2008 and 2009, the attack on Gaza, which killed more than 1,300 Palestinians in just 3 weeks. So the situation is bad, and very unfortunately, our government, the U.S. government, sends at least, and I haven't looked this up lately, so it could be more, but $3 billion in of our tax money every year as military aid to support the Israeli occupation. And all of this stuff I just described, like the conditions under occupation and like what Palestinians are facing, none of that could happen without the support of the U.S. government. So this is really a concern to me and to all of you and to anyone who is concerned with justice here and abroad. So these are some of the kinds of conditions that I wanted to see for myself and that I wanted to hear about from people who live this. This is what I had in mind when I applied to go on the delegation to Palestine in 2009. And I was really excited about the opportunity. I was all scheduled to go with Sarah and with two other people who are both professors in Minnesota, and then we were gonna meet up with like three or four other people from Chicago, and this was all gonna be part of this delegation that was gonna happen in August of 2009, organized by the Palestine Solidarity Group. But as Sarah referred to, when Sarah and I and our third traveling companion, Karen Sullivan, as we got there and were questioned at the airport in Tel Aviv, we were told that we were being denied entry for security reasons. And like Sarah said, at the time, we just thought like, oh man, they were onto us. How did they know? And you know, we thought we did something wrong, or I thought they just Googled my name and they, you know, found out what we were really up to. And I should just say, because even if they Google my name, like why should that be a reason that I don't get to go on this trip, right? Well, when you travel to Israel, for any of you who have, you'll know what I'm talking about. You don't just get to walk in and like, hi, welcome, you know, welcome to Israel. There is a very rigorous security protocol that they go through, and they question each and every person, and they want to know who you are and what you're doing and where you're going to be staying and what are your intentions in their country. And we knew, because we were told by people who have done this before, that you cannot tell them that you are there to meet with Palestinians as part of a political delegation, because they don't want you doing that. So we said we were there as tourists, because in a lot of ways we were, and we, you know, we were going to be going around and seeing the sites and learning what there was to be learned. And anyway, but we were told we were a security threat. Our belongings were searched completely. They took every single item out of our luggage and went through it. A total of probably 12 people were part of that searching process. And then, of course, they didn't find any weapons or anything at all threatening. And when they put it all back, I thought that they were going to let us in, because I was thinking, like, well, why would they go through all that and search everything? Of course, they're not going to find anything bad. You know, why would they go through all that if they were just going to deny us entry? But that's what they did. And so the three of us, Sarah, Karen, and I, had a decision to make. Are we going to get back on the plane like they're telling us, or are we going to say no? And so Sarah and I had a conversation, and we agreed that we were not just going to cooperate with this, because the whole purpose of the trip is to to witness the injustice of the occupation, so that we can come back to the United States and tell people about it in order to expose it. And if we just get right back on the plane because that's what they're telling us to do, we're going to be cooperating with exactly with everything that's wrong. And so Sarah and I agreed to stay. Interestingly, Karen didn't want to. She was like, well, I have a daughter and I don't want to get caught up in this. And so I'm just going to go back on the plane, but good luck, you know. And I remember, like, I gave her a hug and I was like, it's okay, don't feel bad, do what you got to do, you know, take care of yourself, we'll see you when we get back. And for those of you who are chuckling, I think a lot of you probably know that Karen Sullivan was not our friend. She was not who she said she was, and we did not know this at the time, but she was actually an FBI agent or a law enforcement officer of some kind who was working with the FBI. So there is no chance that we were ever going to get in to Israel, and it's not because we did anything wrong or that the Israelis magically figured this out, but they were informed by Karen and Karen's law enforcement people well in advance. So I'm trying to think of how to wrap up here. I think the title of this talk was going to be like oppression abroad and then how it leads to repression at home. And I think this story and what's happening now is a really prime example of that. We've got U.S. tax dollars that are going to perpetrate very serious injustices in Israel and Palestine, and people who are trying to learn about it and expose it and stand against it are now being targeted in this country and are receiving some of the same kind of labels that Palestinians are marked with, you know, like you're a terrorist or you're providing material support for terrorism. And which, you know, there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of emotion attached to those words, and it's a really serious thing. And Jordan's going to talk a little bit more about the material support law and what this all means from a legal perspective. But I guess I'll just say that as an international solidarity activist, I don't regret anything that I've done. I wish that this trip would have been able to go forward, but I think all that I can do and all that we can do with this is to learn from it and to talk about it and to spread our story and the truth about what's really happening, and also tell people about what they can do. And so, you know, you guys are sitting here. I would just say, if you can read more about what's really happening, there's a great website. There's a ton of resources, I'm sure, but just one that's really good is the website ifamericansknew.org. It's a really good source of information about what's going on in Israel-Palestine. So you can, you know, read that, talk to people about what's really happening, contact your elected officials and say that you do not support aid for Israel. And then the other thing you can do is you can support solidarity activists who are targeted. And like Sarah mentioned, there's going to be a protest on Tuesday at the federal building, 4:30, to support the newly subpoenaed activists, the 9 new people in Chicago who are being targeted. And I'm going to be there, and I really appreciate as many people and as good of a turnout as we can get to show those folks how much we're standing with them in this difficult time.